Whatever falls from the sky above, thou shalt not curse it. That includes the rain. No matter what might pour down, no matter how heavy the cloud burst, or how icy the sleet, you should never ever utter profanities against whatever the heavens might have in store for us. Everybody knows this, and that includes Zeliha.
Welcome to Book Tour. I am Neda Ulubi. Turkish author Elif Shafak was acquitted 2 years ago for, quote, insulting Turkishness. That charge has been leveled against dozens of Turkish authors, and it's made some of them, including Shafak and Nobel winner Orhan Pamuk, minor celebrities in the West. But Elif Shafak is also a best-selling author in Turkey, and this novel is steeped in the sights, colors, and smells of its capital. The Bastard of Istanbul grapples with the dark legacies of last century's Armenian genocide, but it's also a novel about women, including the title character, a headstrong Turkish teenage girl who adores Johnny Cash. Elif Shafak is a practicing Sufi who was brought up all over the world. This is her sixth novel and her second book written first in English. This reading of The Bastard of Istanbul was recorded in February 2008 at the Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C.
Thank you so much for coming. It is a big pleasure for me to be here this evening. And I also very much look forward to hearing your questions, your thoughts, your comments, so that we can turn this into a dialogue. But what I was thinking was perhaps to read a little bit, you know, just to give you a taste of the book, a very brief passage. For those of you who might not be familiar with the book, and for those of you who are familiar with the book, maybe it will help you to remember the rhythm of the novel. And then afterwards, maybe say a few words about themes that are very dear to my heart, that are important to me, and then we can open it up for discussion and, as I said, hopefully turn this into a dialogue. The Bastard of Istanbul is my seventh book. I wrote two novels in English, The Saint of Incipient Insanities and The Bastard of Istanbul. These were originally written in English. And then my most recent book, The Black Milk, which just came out in Turkey, that was written in Turkish. So basically, I write fiction in both languages, and I feel connected to each language in different ways, and maybe this is something we can talk about. For those of you who know the book, each chapter carries the name of one particular ingredient. And overall, the book is composed like a cauldron of aşure, a very favorite dessert for us Turks. And the first chapter is called Cinnamon. Whatever falls from the sky above, thou shalt not curse it. That includes the rain. No matter what might pour down, no matter how heavy the cloud burst, or how icy the sleet, you should never ever utter profanities against whatever the heavens might have in store for us. Everybody knows this, and that includes Zeliha. Yet there she was, on this first Friday of July, walking on a sidewalk that flowed next to hopelessly clogged traffic, rushing to an appointment she was now late for, swearing like a trooper, hissing one profanity after another at the broken pavement stones, at her high heels, at the men stalking her, at each and every driver who honked frantically, when it was an urban fact that clamor had no effect on unclogging traffic, at the whole Ottoman dynasty, for once upon a time, conquering the city of Constantinople and then sticking by its mistake, and yes, at the rain, this damned summer rain. Rain is an agony here. In other parts of the world, a downpour will in all likelihood come as a boon for nearly everyone and everything. It's good for the crops, good for the fauna and the flora, and with an extra splash of romanticism, it's good for lovers. Not so in Istanbul, though. Rain for us isn't necessarily about getting wet. It's not about getting dirty, even. If anything, it's about getting angry. It is mud and chaos and rage, as if we didn't have enough of each already. And struggle, it is always about struggle. Like kittens thrown into a bucket full of water, all 10 million of us put up a futile fight against the drops. It can't be said that we're completely alone in the scuffle, for the streets, too, are in on it with their old names and the tombstones of so many saints scattered in all directions, the piles of garbage that wait on almost every corner, the hideously huge construction pits soon to be turned into glitzy modern buildings, and the seagulls. It angers us all when the sky opens and spits on our heads. But then, as the final drops reach the ground, and many more perch unsteadily on the now dustless leaves, at that unprotected moment, when you're not quite sure that it has finally ceased raining, and neither is the rain itself, in that very moment, everything becomes serene. For one long minute, the sky seems to apologize for the mess she has left us in, and we, with driblets still in our hair, slush in our cuffs, and dreariness in our gaze, stare back at the sky, now a lighter shade of blue and clearer than ever. We look up and can't help smiling back. We forgive her. We always do. At the moment, however, it was still pouring and Zeliha had little, if any, forgiveness in her heart. She did not have an umbrella, for she had promised herself that if she was enough of an idiot to throw a bunch of money to yet another street vendor for yet another umbrella, only to forget it here and there as soon as the sun came back, then she deserved to be soaked to the bone. Besides, it was too late now anyway. She was already sopping wet. That was the one thing about the rain that likened it to sorrow. You did your best to remain untouched, safe and dry, but if and when you failed, there came a point in which you started seeing the problem, less in terms of drops than as an incessant gush, and thereby you decide you might as well get drenched. Rain dripped from her dark curls onto her broad shoulders. Like all the women in the Kazancı family, Zeliha had been born with frizzy raven-black hair, but unlike the others, she liked to keep it that way. From time to time, her eyes of jade green, normally wide open and filled with intelligence, squinted into two lines of untainted indifference inherent only to three groups of people: the hopelessly naive, the hopelessly withdrawn, and the hopelessly full of hope. She being none of these, it was hard to make sense of this indifference, even if it was such a flickering one. One minute it was here, canopying her soul to drugged insensibility. The next minute it was gone, leaving her alone in her body. Thus she felt, on that first Friday of July, desensitized as if anesthetized, a powerfully corrosive mood for someone so zestful as she. Could this be why she had had absolutely no interest in fighting the city today, or the rain for that matter? While the yo-yo indifference went up and down with a rhythm all its own, the pendulum of her mood swayed between two opposite poles, from frozen to fuming. As Zeliha rushed by, the street vendors selling umbrellas and raincoats and plastic scarves in glowing colors eyed her in amusement. She managed to ignore their gaze, just as she managed to ignore the gaze of all the men who stared at her body with hunger. The vendors looked disapprovingly at her shiny nose ring too, as if therein lay a clue as to her deviance from modesty, and thereby the sign of her lustfulness. She was especially proud of her piercing because she had done it herself. It had hurt, but the piercing was here to stay, and so was her style. Be it the harassment of men or the reproach of other women, the impossibility of walking on broken cobblestones or hopping into the ferry boats, and even her mother's constant nagging, there was no power on earth that could prevent Zeliha, who was taller than most women in the city, from donning miniskirts of glaring colors, tight-fitting blouses that displayed her ample breasts, nylon stockings, and yes, those towering high heels. Now, as she stepped on another loose cobblestone and watched the puddle of sludge underneath splash dark stains on her lavender skirt, Zeliha unleashed another long chain of curses. She was the only woman in the whole family and one of the few among all Turkish women who used such foul language so unreservedly and knowledgeably. Thus, whenever she started swearing, she kept going as if to compensate for all the rest. This time was no different. As she ran, Zeliha swore at the municipal administration, past and present, because ever since she was a little girl, never a rainy day had passed with these cobblestones primed and fixed. Before she was done swearing, however, she abruptly paused, lifted her chin as if suspecting someone had called her name, but rather than looking around for an acquaintance, she instead looked at the smoky sky. She squinted, sighed a conflicted sigh, and then unleashed another profanity, only this time against the rain. Now, according to the unwritten and unbreakable rules of Petima, her grandmother, that was sheer blasphemy. You might not be fond of the rain, you certainly did not have to be, but under no circumstances should you swear at anything that came from the skies, because nothing poured from above on its own, and behind it all, there was Allah, the Almighty. So I'll stop here. As I said, that was just to give you a taste of the rhythm. And why I'm saying rhythm, because language is a big, big, big passion for me. I do not see language as an instrument, as a tool, you know, a vehicle that's outside me, something that I use and then put aside. Rather than that, I think I see language as a continent, as a space. You know, I enter inside language, or I try to do that. And I write with language, within language. It has always been a big, big passion for me. And sometimes I feel like a mystic, like an Islamic mystic. I think I like to follow the miracle of the letters. It seems miraculous to me that by changing the places of the letters, you acquire endless meanings. So I'm fascinated by that process, maybe ever since I was a child. What I'm trying to say is I think language is a big, big passion for me. And for those of you who are perhaps more familiar with my Turkish, it's the same thing in Turkish. My Turkish is a combination of old words with new words, Sufi words, because I am very much interested in that culture, in that heritage, and I try to bring expressions and words and concepts from that background into modern Turkish novel and perhaps combine these different words. And that continuity in language is important to me. Writing in English, on the other hand, was a completely different experience for me. English is a very mathematical language for me, for an outsider, for a foreigner. I did not grow up bilingual, so English is an acquired language for me. And that means it's a bit risky. As a writer, when I started writing in English, I was already a published author, perhaps an established author, in Turkey, in my language. But at that point, I had nothing translated into English yet. So in a way, coming from Istanbul to Boston, I believe 4 years ago, if not earlier, was a very existential move for me. And I experienced that as a move from the Turkish language inside the English language. And I enjoyed it. You know, in a day you become nobody. Because if you're a painter, you can take your paintings with you. If you're a documentary maker, you can take your documentaries with you wherever you go. You go to Vietnam, you go to China, you know, you take your products, your art with you. But if you're a writer, and if you have, let's say, nothing translated, all right, then you become a nobody. And it's a big existential challenge. And we writers are people with very inflated egos. We always like to think we are somebody. So it was a big challenge for me, you know, thinking that I was somebody in Istanbul and then coming to Boston and becoming nobody. But I liked it. I liked that freedom. And I realized every language is a different labyrinth. Every language has its own advantages and perhaps weaknesses. Turkish for me is a very emotional language. I think it's a beautiful language. It's an amazingly rich language. I very much enjoy writing in Turkish. And it is based on a very interesting structure of agglutination, like a train. You keep adding suffixes. So with one word, playing with suffixes, I can change the meaning so much. For a writer, for a poet, it's an amazing language. Nevertheless, when it comes to vocabulary, English has a huge advantage. The vocabulary, the mathematical, for me, as I said, that's the way I see it, structure of the English language is fascinating. It's the language of precision. If you're looking for the precise word, it's right out there. You know, all you need to do is just grab it, reach out for it. Whereas in the case of Turkish, we lost many words as we moved from the Ottoman Empire to the modern nation state. Many words that came from Arabic origin, Persian origin, were taken out. So today we have a more limited vocabulary. And as a writer, that troubles me from time to time. But maybe we'll talk about these things if you have, you know, any questions in that regard. But basically, I think what I'm trying to say is I feel connected to each language in a different way. For a while, I thought if it's humor that I'm dealing with, maybe I'm more comfortable doing that with this language, with the English language. If I'm talking about the past, maybe with a bit of sorrow, I prefer Turkish. That's my grandmother's language. Also because Turkish, interestingly, has two different past tenses, which doesn't exist in many other languages. So it gives you an opportunity to write in what we call masal zamanı, the time of the folk tales, you know. Not something that you personally experienced, but you heard, you can imagine. It's an imaginary past tense. So it's very rich in that regard as well. But very briefly, I mean, I can summarize by saying I started writing at a very early age, and my connection with the art of fiction runs deep, but not because I wanted to become a novelist at an early age. That desire came to me much later, in my early 20s. But the need to write came much earlier, when I was a young child in Spain, and that's because I spent a very lonely childhood. I was very introverted. I was raised by a single mom and didn't have, you know, very colorful things in my daily life, or that's the way I saw it. So books were the most colorful things, I think, in my life. I read a lot and I had diaries, but I never wrote the truth in those notebooks because the truth was so boring. So I wrote about people that didn't exist, about events that had never occurred. Basically, you know, you're lying, you're imagining things. But that's how it started. And then those diaries evolved into short stories evolved into novels. I like the genre of the novel. For someone who is as impatient as me, it's a very difficult genre because, you know, it requires patience and faith, you know, perhaps long-term planning. That has balanced me in different ways. But what I'm trying to say is writing has always been with me. The desire to become a published author came much later. And for a while, I think I thought writing was my suitcase. You know, it was one thing I could take with me wherever I went as I moved from one country to another, because life has been nomadic for me. I was born in Strasbourg, France. I was raised in Spain and spent parts of my life in different cities. And writing always came with me. It gave me a sense of continuity in time. I saw it as an existential glue that hold my pieces together. That's why I think my connection with the art of fiction or the process of writing runs very deep. That said, lastly, I just want to add, I always thought because my connection was so deep in my eyes, I would never have a writer's block. But I experienced that was not true. Last year, I had this huge rupture after giving birth to my daughter. For like 10 months, I couldn't write anything. And that was a big, big depression for me, a source of depression, or my depression triggered that. I don't know, maybe it was a vicious circle. But it taught me a lot. It taught me that, well, even writing is something you can't take for granted. And after those 10 months, I finished my latest book, The Black Milk. I wrote day and night without stopping. It was a bit insane. Like in 3 months, the book was done. But only then I realized those 10 months of not writing the book, those 10 months of block, was perhaps also part of the process of writing. You know, somehow that too is included in the making of the book. So that writing comes with all these ups and downs, I think, and those two should be maybe recognized. But basically, that process, that experience taught me that motherhood, being a writer, being a nomadic writer, and a mother who is more concerned about, you know, settling down, these are things that might be difficult to balance from time to time. And as beautiful as motherhood is, it has its own conflicts, and perhaps many other women all around the world are experiencing similar problems. So The Black Milk, in that sense, has been an autobiographical book for me. Out of my 8 books, it's my only autobiographical work, Because fiction, as I understand, is not telling your own story to other people. Fiction for me is the ability to dream, to put yourself in the shoes of other people, to empathize, to look at the same story from different angles, to keep shifting, you know, to be a nomad at heart, to keep moving always. In that sense, it's the ability to be someone else. And again, in that regard, I think I see a big similarity between Sufism and the art of fiction, because I think in both, the quest, the need to transcend the boundaries of the self is essential, to go beyond those boundaries. And in the art of fiction, I think it enables you to go beyond national boundaries, religious boundaries, class boundaries, gender boundaries, boundaries of every sort, and to empathize with other people all around the world. So I'll stop here, and I truly look forward to your questions, your comments, and going on from there.
I've been looking forward to your reading for probably a year or something when I first read about this book. So I have two questions. The first one is, I don't see any note about the translation, so I'm wondering who translated it, and perhaps it was you, or perhaps it was written in English, after what you've said. Mm-hmm. And if not, what was your involvement in the English mm-hmm. version? Mm-hmm. And the second one is, all the chapters, I haven't finished the book, all the chapters are a name of some food, except for the last one, I'm pretty sure. And so I was wondering if you could comment on that.
Okay.
Thank you very much. And I am of Armenian descent, by the way.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much for those beautiful questions. Actually, this book was originally written in English. I wrote it in English, and then it was translated into Turkish. This and the previous novel, The Saint of Incipient Insanities, which was published by Farrar, Straus and Giroux, that too was written in English. That's actually a big experience for me to work with translators, work, you know, from Turkish into English and from English into Turkish. I do not believe in a one-to-one translation in the sense that every language has its own rhythm. So just to give you an idea, for instance, The Saint of Incipient Insanities has a rhythm in English. And when you translate it into Turkish directly, let's say the title of the book, of that book in Turkish is different because that rhythm is lost. Instead, that book, for those of you who know Turkish, is called Araf, which is a very powerful word in Turkish, but basically it means purgatory, you know, limbo, to be in between different identities. And I think that very much reflects the essence of the book. Well, what I'm trying to say is translation for me is a very creative process. And I have a lot of respect for translators, especially translators working, you know, with literary books, doing literary translations. I myself can't do that. So I always work with professional translators. I can't do that for two reasons. First of all, I don't think I have that talent. I mean, it's not enough to speak one language or two or three languages, whatever, to do a proper translation. That's not enough. You require other skills. You know, a translator's position is so interesting. On the one hand, they are so creatively in the process, and on the other hand, they keep, you know, they keep themselves in the background always, and they have the very modest people in that sense. You know, as I said, writers have inflated egos, but with the translators, I think it's just the opposite. I really have a lot of respect, and as I said, I don't do it myself because I don't think I have the ability, the talent to do it myself. But secondly, if I were to do the translation of my books myself, I would interfere so much. You know, it would be a completely different book by the end because I would start saying, okay, why not make it like this and like that? And somebody needs to stop me at that point. So I really enjoy working with professional translators and learn a lot from them. But that said, translation is a big issue for many writers coming from, let's say, the rest of the world. Not the West, but the rest, because it's a one-way road. I mean, books that are published in the Western world are oftentimes very quickly translated into Turkish, into many other languages, but the opposite is not equally true. So, you know, how much of Turkish literature is being translated into English or French or German even, you know, despite the fact that we have such, you know, close ties and there's so many Turks living in Germany. So these things make me sad, trouble me. It always takes time. But what I'm trying to say is, for me, it is important, the issue of translation. Very briefly about food, the cuisine and cooking, it is very important to me, you know, not because of food solely. I think the whole woman's culture is very important to me, and it's very vivid for me. I was raised by my grandmother for some time, and the memories, you know, the things, folk Islam, superstitions, recipes, the tales, the narratives, everything is so vividly, I think, in my, you know, part of my memory, and I like to reflect that. Also, I like to learn from other women. I think writers need to be good listeners, and I listen a lot to other people, to what women say, and I reflect all that in my novels. Not only in this novel, but I think in all my novels you can find traces of women's culture, cuisine, and as I say, especially folk Islam. Please go.
Hi. Yes. Hi. Is writing your chief career, or do you have an additional career to your writing?
You know, depending on the maybe stages of my life, one thing was always the same. I mean, writing has always been the main thing in my life, the main love in my life, in terms of, you know, what I do. But especially in Turkey, I don't know. Maybe it's the same in the States. Can you make a living, you know, by solely writing novels? Is that possible, or do you need to, you know, find some other means to support yourself financially, but not only financially, also intellectually, socially? I also have an academic degree. I have a master's degree in gender studies and a PhD in political science and political thought. And I have taught at different universities, and I think I've always enjoyed that. I learned a lot, really a lot. It's not a very easy combination. That's not a very easy marriage between academia and the literary world, because they speak different languages, they're different approaches. Nevertheless, if we see maybe knowledge like a circle in which everything is interconnected, then you realize how much you learn from, you know, one event in your life, and then you use it somewhere else. Just let me give you an example. In the classroom, a student, let's say, brings up a question, and then you start thinking about that question. And the next day when you're writing a story, that question somehow seeps into the story. We always learn from people. We always learn from other experiences. So I have learned a lot from the academia. I'm not teaching at the moment, but I might go back. As I said, it has always been an important asset for me. I also write for various newspapers and magazines, daily and weekly, and that too has been a good exercise for me. Still, I would say writing has always been the very first thing. I think so. Thank you.
Hi. Who do you look up to as authors, both in Turkish and other languages?
Believe me, there are so many, and my reading lists have always been very eclectic. I enjoy, definitely very much enjoy, Turkish literature and poetry especially, and the art of humor. I think we have an amazing, you know, art of black humor in Turkey. These are things that I enjoy very much, and I read a lot. But I also read Russian literature, you know, Spanish literature, French literature, English, American. It is incredibly heterogeneous, very, very eclectic. But in addition to that, maybe I should say, do writers solely or mainly benefit from other writers' works? You know, is literature our primary source of, I don't know, knowledge or inspiration? I don't think so. I mean, I also, for instance, enjoy reading other realms like religious history or religious philosophy or social history or political philosophy. I enjoy reading Adorno. I enjoy reading, you know, maybe Hannah Arendt. People who are not seemingly directly connected with the world of literature. But you learn so many things from these people as well. I learn a lot from cinema and music, especially songs, lyrics, and also popular culture. I have never belittled popular culture. And as a matter of fact, I think it's quite the opposite. Popular culture has always been very visible, very vibrant in my writing. I read everything, like, you know, women's magazines, horoscope magazines, things that, especially in my country, intellectuals tend to belittle from time to time, because, you know, we like to think we're doing something very serious and important, and we are right high above the clouds, and these things are very trivial. It's not like that. As I said, everything is interconnected. And I learn a lot from women's magazines, those recipes, you know, they most of them come from such places. Or music, as I said, you know, it's always in the background when I'm writing. So it is eclectic in every sense. Thank you.
I really appreciate your honesty in the way you define language and what it means to you, and I think I share your enthusiasm. Mm-hmm. And another thing that you commented on that I'd like to say something about is that you said when writing fiction, you create a story. It doesn't necessarily mm-hmm. have to be your story, but I tend to believe that writers leave their imprints on the characters that they create. Mm-hmm. And when reading The Bastard of Istanbul, I obviously don't know you, but just reading the book sort of made me understand that maybe you left little pieces of you in Zeliha's character in terms of being sort of this outsider and not necessarily connecting on certain levels and having your own identity. And so my question is, I do have a question, believe it or not. My question is about motivation and why you wrote this book in English, why you wrote this book at all. And I'm Turkish, and I'm not one of those close-minded Turks. I actually happen to love Orhan Pamuk, and I wrote a bunch of papers to columnists in Turkey who sort of put him down for winning the Nobel Prize because I thought, well, 10 years from now, no one's going to question why he won the prize. It's just going to be the fact that he did win it as a Turkish writer, and that makes me proud. But reading your book and knowing that your first language is not English, mm-hmm. I couldn't help but question your motivation, because having lived abroad for almost a decade, I always had to constantly defend myself against this Armenian issue. I mean, it's not that I don't believe that there were people killed on both sides. I just don't think that it's up to certain powers to decide, and I'd rather leave it up to historians. So I was just wondering why you decided to write this book and why you wrote mm-hmm, it in English. Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Just maybe I can start with a small note. This is not my first novel in English. Okay, and I don't know if you questioned my motivations when you read The Saint of Incipient Insanities. That book, too, was written in English. Actually, I started writing in English not as a result of a rational choice. It's very difficult for me to explain this because it is very irrational, but it was like an animal instinct. I love language. I love to discover language. As I said, I experience it as a continent, you know, to always go beyond the limits. I wish I could write in Spanish. I would love to try that. I wish I could write in a fourth language. Really, honestly, I would love to do that, because in each language you discover, and as someone who has been living abroad for such a long time, maybe you will share my thoughts, you are a different person in each language. You rediscover yourself in a different light. I always think about the same example, but I have met Turkish women, you know, upper-class women, middle-class women, who have been brought, told to be always, you know, nice and modest people, right? Women who can never swear in Turkish, including myself, okay? But most of these women can swear very freely in English, because it's okay to swear in English. I have met women, the other day one of my readers was telling me she can, you know, she grew up bilingual, she can swear very freely in Arabic, but not in English, vice versa. In every language, we have an additional zone of existence. Perhaps we don't speak one language anyhow. We speak a different language with our mothers, with our friends, with our children, you know, with our peers, etc. So that multiplicity of language is very important for me. Some people criticized me in Turkey, thinking that I had abandoned the Turkish language. How can I abandon my mother tongue? You know, is that possible? Why experience this as an abandonment? You know, as if you have to make a choice between this or that. Why can't we have both? Maybe you prefer to write poetry in English, and then you prefer to write novels in Turkish. Or you prefer to write academic papers in English, because the language facilitates that. And then you prefer to write your essays in Turkish. I think that's perfectly possible, and that's perfectly okay. It is an enrichment, and it should be encouraged. So I defend that. This is why I keep writing in English. I learn from it. It's a difficult experience for me. It's not an easy choice. It wasn't an easy choice. But every time, you know, I come back to the Turkish language, I hear it differently. I appreciate it more. I hear its rhythm. I think it sometimes takes a latecomer or maybe an outsider or a foreigner to notice the details that the natives, or in this case the native speakers, fail to notice, you know, because they take it for granted. Or vice versa. Sometimes when I'm writing in English or thinking in English, I notice the, you know, very minute details that maybe people don't hear anymore or see anymore, because to them it's very normal. So those voyages between languages or continents or cultures, I think they are very stimulating, both intellectually and spiritually. And if we have an open heart and an open mind, we got a lot to learn from those bilingual or multilingual or multicultural experiences. I'm someone who defends that. Now, about the second thing, why did I start writing this book? I did not start writing this book with very grand aims or projects. I don't know how familiar you are with my all other books, but when I look at my works retrospectively with a hindsight, each and every one of them is so different, because I was a different person at each juncture. You know, I was a different person at each period. I change. It's, as I said, it is a journey. Writing is a journey. Life is a journey. You move on, you take a new topic, you think about it, and then you write again and again. For me, I don't care about, you know, this political categories or dogmas. I'm interested in literature. I'm interested in individual human beings, in people's, as I said, human beings, sorrows and happinesses. I'm not interested in generalizations. I look at the individuals, at one family, one woman. So I started with a very micro, if I may say, scope, not macro aims. And to be frank, the very first scene that came to my mind when I started writing this book was Zeliha walking under the rain, you know, with her high heels broken. You ask me an interesting question. You say, do you associate yourself in a way with Zeliha? Yes and no. I also associate myself with many other characters in the book, including Auntie Banu, or maybe even the grandmother character who's a little bit nasty. Otherwise, I couldn't write about these people. You know, all those characters, that some of them have maybe weaknesses, failures, flaws, I know them because they're my flaws, my failures. I learned a lot from Sufism, and Sufism teaches me that everything that I see in the macrocosmos is also present inside me. Everything that I criticize outside me is also part of myself. So those connections are very important to me, and I apply that to my literature in the sense that I do feel a connection with myself and all these fictional characters. I do not believe in heroes. I never create heroes, you know, absolutely positive or purely courageous, you know, brave characters, good characters. I think there's no such thing. As human beings, we all have our positive sides and weaknesses. Someone who seems very courageous has her maybe cowardice, or vice versa. Those details intrigue me as a writer, and I apply them on paper. So yes, there's a connection between Zeliha and me, but believe me, from Pinhan, my first novel onwards, which is the story of a hermaphrodite Sufi dervish, there's a connection between all my fictional characters and myself. And this is important. Perhaps at the first glance, one of the main characters of Pinhan is the hermaphrodite dervish. In Mahram, I talk about the love of a very, very fat woman who's not very comfortable in the society, and her love with a dwarf living in Istanbul. It's a book in which the theme of the gaze is very central. Or in The Mirrors of the City, my historical novel, the second book, I talk about Jewish conversos. It is the story of Jews, some of them coming to Constantinople, to Istanbul. Now, at the first glance, when you put all these fictional characters side by side, none of them is me, because, you know, it looks like I have nothing in common with these personalities. As I said, this is what literature is so, why literature is so fascinating. You know, someone who looks very unlike you might have something in common, because I think in life we are all interconnected, and writers are connected to their fictional characters, but I do not choose one character and put her to the fore at the expense of others. Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more readings like this one, please visit npr.org/booktour.